So we're going to look at these. Let's just kind of start with this first one. And it is that joy is possible. The Bible tells us, like I said, over and over again, that it's possible. The one that we just read, right? Psalm 1. Blessed or joyful or happy is the man that does these things or doesn't do these other things. It's possible. You can be blessed. You can be joyful. You can be happy. And then it goes on to tell us some things that you probably shouldn't be doing if you want to be, and things that you should be doing if you do want to be. We'll look at those a little more. Jesus himself said that joy was possible. He says, I've told you these things so that my joy and delight may be in you. Now, was he just playing a cruel joke or did he really mean it? He said it can be in you and that your joy not only would be in him, but it would be made full and complete and overflowing. I always like the Amplified version. You know, it's got so many more words because the chief editor was a woman. So it's just so much more words in there, but it's good stuff. Good stuff. All right. Now, joy, again, it doesn't mean that it's a permanent condition. And we're going to talk about that because it's powerful. It can actually be in you simultaneously with pain. But it never leaves. But sometimes emotionally, we have a sense that it's gone. And we don't have to just resign ourselves to that state either. Like, oh, I guess it's just the way it is. Because David was depressed, the king, right? Many characters in the Bible dealt with depression, but they didn't just resign themselves. David was wiped out, man. He had really messed up. We know that. And when we mess up, we lose our joy. But David said, I'm not going to just stew here. I'm not going to just live here. He cried out to God and he said, restore to me the joy of my salvation. So it can be restored. That should be encouraging to us that it's possible. Joy is possible. Now, some people might be saying, well, that's really profound, Greg. I came out here this morning to find out that joy is possible. Well, here's the deal. If you hear that and say, you know, joy is possible, and your reply is, well, let's say this. If you hear the phrase joy is possible, and you don't say, well, man, I hope so, but your response is more like, well, of course it is, more than likely, I would say you're much younger. You're probably under 18 or even younger. I mean, for me, I had a very protected life. I mean, there are people, sadly, and I've talked to an overwhelming amount of people that I had no idea had just unbelievably, unusually harsh childhoods. But there are a lot of us, just to encourage some of you, that didn't. I mean, I'm embarrassed how happy and how sheltered I was all the way through 18 years old. I've told you that. Basically, the only challenges I had in life for the first 18 years was how long I was going to sleep and what I was going to do for fun after I got up. You know, so somebody says to me, joy is possible. What do you mean possible? You know, I mean, it's just a natural byproduct of life, you know? And then, of course, life goes on. Things start happening. You know, and then you start to remember, you know, my parents gave me dire warnings like, you know what, don't spend all your money, man. Life is tough. Oh, come on, please. What do you mean life is tough? Life is fun. What's not to be happy about? But after a while, man, you experience more and more of life. And, man, joy isn't anywhere as easy as you thought it was, is it? Life has a way of waking us up. And, you know, the movies make us think otherwise, right? So many movies, everybody comes back in the end, you know. Everything's happy in the end. The one that everybody wants gets to marry in the end, you know. And listen, we need those stories just to get through life. You know, I remember when Tina's sister died, we watched Little House on the Prairie all 7 seasons or whatever it was, you know. I mean, just everything always works out, you know. It just sometimes you need to see that stuff to get through. But, man, there's a reality to life. And there are movies that are about those realities, and they don't usually sell as much. I remember one, man. I think it was around the early 90s there was a movie, and it's about this immigration lawyer. You know, he's got plenty of money, got an expensive car, and then he ends up getting stuck in a traffic jam. And so he decides, you know, he gets frustrated. I mean, New Yorkers, we know all about that, right? And then he finally decides, man, I'm just going to try and avoid this thing. So the next exit, he gets off and starts working his way through the streets just to try and beat the traffic jam. Of course, this is before GPSs, right? So he gets, you know, you ever do that? I've done that, man. I think it was before Alyssa was born, but I had Brandon, who was small, and Tara, and man, I tried cutting through somewhere, and I was like, I don't think we should be here, you know? And this guy does the same thing. You know, he's got the expensive car, lawyer. He's cutting through the back streets, and things are looking darker and darker and seedier, and then his car stops, stalls out on him. It's dark, you know? No cell phone. This is before the advent of cell phones, so he finds a payphone, is able to call a tow truck. But while he's waiting, of course, five thugs surround his car, you know, and they're just having a good time. Oh, do we need help? You know, yo, man, get out of your car, you know. And in the middle of it, the tow truck driver shows up. This is the early 90s, so it's a younger Danny Glover, right? He gets out of his tow truck with the tire iron and all that stuff, and he just ignores these guys and starts hooking up the tow truck to this guy's car. And these guys are like, yo, man, what are you doing? Like, he's interrupting their free meal, you know? And he's like, what are you doing here? And there's this great line where Glover looks over at the guy, and he just kind of gives this guy a quick five-line synopsis of great biblical theology, as far as I'm concerned. He looks over at the guy, he says, man, the world ain't supposed to be this way. I don't know if you know that. But it just ain't supposed to be this way. Listen, I'm supposed to be able to come here and do my job without me having to ask you if I can, all right? And this dude over here is supposed to be able to be in his car and wait for me without having to worry whether he's going to be ripped off or not. The world just ain't supposed to be like this. That's it. Did you ever read Genesis 1? The world ain't supposed to be like this, people. Well, we're not supposed to have to worry if we're going to get ripped off or beat up or killed or have to go to war or have disease and famine and all of these things. God didn't design the world that way. And guess what? He didn't design you that way either. So guess what happens? We get unhappy. We don't have joy because we find ourselves thrust into an environment that was never originally created this way, and we weren't wired to have to live in the midst of it. But let me tell you this too, God doesn't just make something to have it fall apart and unravel and be destroyed. But man, if he creates something and it goes wrong, he intends on redeeming it. And Jesus says, I'm coming back. And guess what? Amen. Things are going to be the way they're supposed to be. Woo! Right, you're starting to get this joy thing now, huh? See, that's how it works, you know. It's not no pie-in-the-sky thing. That's his promise, man. Everything else will pass away. He said, my words will not pass away. But here's some good news for you, too. In the meantime, in between time, while you're living in this polluted, fallen environment, Jesus was very real about it. He said in John 16:33, he says, listen, in this world, you will have trouble. Right, we've all heard that. He didn't say maybe. He didn't say you might. He said, you will have trouble. But then after that, he says, but take heart. I love the way the King James says it. It says, but be of good cheer. Because there's a little implication there in that Greek word that there's a joy in that, taking heart. Be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. God says, I'm going to be with you, man. You're not just left on your own. We're going to work through this thing. I'm going to give you a joy that can work through it. Now, I saw this thing. I thought it was kind of cool. It gives you a list of four ways in which people kind of view joy. Okay? Here's the first group. First group, They think joy is natural. Now, I already talked about that. You know, usually it means you're pretty inexperienced. I don't know, unless you've had this really unbelievably charmed life. You know, I know, really isolated. I don't see how you're going to think joy is natural. And then maybe unless, of course, you're just under that theological category called stupid. I mean, come on, really, you know, joy is natural. So some people think, I guess, you know, I used to when I was young, think that joy is natural. But then you got the other extreme end of the spectrum, right? The second group, they think joy is unachievable. You know what's wild, though? That group is some of the greatest thinkers we've ever had. Because if you're gifted with being able to use more than 0.5% of your brain, like me and some other people, they start, and you don't have the Lord, man. You don't have that hope we were just talking about, things going back the way they're supposed to be. It's pretty depressing. I don't know about you. I mean, this is really depressing, even if you do well. You know, like that bumper sticker, the one that dies with the most toys? You don't really win anything. I mean, really, you work hard for what? Get put 6 feet under, you know, oh, we have the memories. Yeah, well, I don't think so, man. I need more than memories. So these guys can think deep, man, and they have some really cool, insightful stuff, but they're depressed. They just, you know, so one group thinks joy is natural. The other group thinks, they say it's absolutely unattainable. Now, here's where most of us live, the third group. You just don't think. We're too busy. You know, I don't have time to get into all this stuff. How did these big thinkers get the money to sit around and think all the time anyway, right? You ever think about that? Oh, yeah, and I went on this thing, you know, I went off on a trip. Yeah, man, where'd you get your money to do that, you know? Most of us, we don't even have time to think. You know, we're trying to pay bills, and we're going to soccer games with the kids, or we're trying to pay the tuition. You know, we're just trying to take care of ourselves. We don't even have time to think about the whole thing until something happens, man, and all of a sudden you're faced with the reality of your mortality. I was at one of those last night, right, Steve? Steve was there. Funeral. Saturday night. That's a nice way to spend your Saturday night. I should have invited you. People are busy, man. Then all of a sudden, we're faced with the reality. You know, because we're just living like we're going to be here forever. Ain't happening. Faced with mortality. That's a third group. But here's the fourth group that the Bible tells about us. It's Christians that really understand the Bible. They don't say, listen, joy isn't natural. But it's not just unachievable, but it's possible. It's possible. It's there for us. It's in the Bible. It doesn't just come naturally, but we have to kind of think things through. I mean, the Bible shows us incredible examples of people that have this joy, but it's there, and it can kind of almost simultaneously exist along with pain and discouragement. You know, you ever look at that Psalm 23? It doesn't say, I'm going to exempt you from the valley of the shadow of death. It says, no, I'm going to be with you. It's something that undergirds you and carries you through those places in life. How about, who is it, Horatio Spafford, who wrote that old hymn, man. You look at some of those old hymns. I mean, that guy lost most of his family in a shipwreck. And then he goes, I don't know how much later, but sometime later he wrote a hymn. And he says, you know what, man? When sorrows, they're real. But when those sorrows come like sea bellows, they just roll over you. Whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. It is well with my soul. I mean, really? It's possible? Man, I mean, it's overwhelming to think of one kid gone. That ain't natural, gang. It's supernatural. So here's the deal. If joy is possible, then how come so few people have it? Well, I think because a lot of us go about it the wrong way. So that's what we're going to look at, this next thing. Number two, joy is determined by your allegiance, not your environment. Major mistake. We always gravitate back to it, don't we? I do all the time. We think it's about circumstances, you know? So we put all this time and energy trying to control our environment. You know, get my retirement account just right and take care of my health and take these vitamins and make sure the bills are... Listen, we got to do all that stuff. But if that's your major focus, you're headed for big disappointment because you can only control your environment to a certain degree. You know, like the old saying is, no matter how many vitamins you take and how many plastic surgeries you have, you're basically just rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, right? I mean, it's going down. So you're going to need something a lot more substantial than just trying to control an environment that ultimately only God has control of. So what can we control? It can't be your circumstances outside of you that are going to determine your joy. It's got to be something that's inside of you. You ever hear that old couplet? It says, two men looked out from prison bars. One saw mud and the other saw stars. Same prison, same bars, same identical circumstances, and one of them sees mud, the other one sees stars. Obviously, it's not the circumstances surrounding them, but what's in them that makes the difference. What's in you, man, is going to determine your allegiance. Psalm 1 again. Again, great meditation, man, if you're wrestling with depression. Go into this thing. Psalm 1, it says, blessed, joyful, happy is the man who does not. Isn't that interesting? First of all, there may be some allegiances that you need to change. And then he goes through the list. Now, if I was really with it, like some pastors, I'd list the next parts of the scripture, and I realized I didn't do it. So I'm just going to have to tell you what it says. I think a lot of us know anyway. Right? Because he goes on from that, and he says, blessed is the man who does not. What does he not do? Well, first of all, he doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly or the wicked. What are you listening to? Really? What's on your radio? I mean, listen, it's good to hear the news, but man, don't do that 24/7 news channel, man. You got to be so wiped out. You want to get rid of your joy, just put the news on for 24/7, you know? I mean, go in some people's houses, they got the news channel on all the time. I mean, that's a recipe for suicide, not joy. What are you listening to? You know, I'm going to sound like one of those old-fashioned preachers, but listen, man, I enjoy secular music, but I can't live there. You just can't. Music's too spiritual. You need to feed your soul with it. In fact, you need to recognize that it feeds your soul, whether you want to recognize that or not. You can't walk. You can't listen to the counsel. What are you listening to, right? Where are you walking? And then the next one is, don't stand in the path of sinners. That has to do with behavior. What are you doing? Because listen, you know, your soul and your body are inextricably connected. That is the theology of the Bible, man. God made this body and then he breathed into it and it became a living soul. They're connected. And so whatever you do with your body affects your soul. That's just the way it is. So we got to be real about our behavior. It's not realistic. It's not being legalistic, man. It's the way it is. You know, you take this temple and do certain things with it, it's really severely inhibits your ability to experience God's Spirit and to walk in it and the fruit that comes with it. And then the last one is he doesn't sit in the seat of the scoffers. I saw something that said that sitting is like Semitic language for where you belong. Where do you live? You know, if you sit with the Romans, then you're part of the Romans. You are what your friends are, right? You sit with the Greeks, you're part of the Greeks, man. So where are you sitting? Where is it that you live. It's going to determine where you belong. That's from the negative side. Then the psalmist goes into the positive side. And he says this. He says, blessed, joyful, happy is the person or the man where their delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. Man, that's where you're listening. That's where you're walking. That's where you belong. Now, somebody might say, well, his law, that's Old Testament, isn't it? What, are you supposed to meditate on his rules? He's not talking about the rules of God. He's talking about taking the word of God as a rule for life. He's talking about the totality of this book. What's the foundation upon which you're basing your whole emotional equilibrium on? What is it that you base your decisions on? What is it when you make a decision, what is the foundation by which you make that decision? Basically, it comes down to either the word or the world. And they're getting a lot further apart every day, I hate to tell you. So we just have to make that decision. Are you going to meditate in that? Are you going to make it your rule for life? The psalmist says, when that allegiance is there, then you become like this tree that's by a stream. And it's no longer dependent on the outward circumstances, but it's got roots that go deep, and it's got its own resource for its joy with that stream. But you know what I like about it? It says it has seasons. It bears its fruit in its season. That means, you know, sometimes it's winter, man. It's 20 below. It's nasty out there. And you're just not bearing a whole lot of fruit. You may hit a summer and it's a drought. And you're just dry and parched. But you know what? Your leaves don't wither. I read one thing where it said, well, maybe he's talking about an evergreen tree. Because their leaves don't wither, right? That's evergreen, always green. So God is... He says, listen, you're going to have seasons, man, and it's going to hit you, but your leaves won't wither. In other words, listen, you know, you may lose your job, or maybe your success is going to be snatched from you. Maybe you're waiting at the altar, and the one you're waiting for never shows up, and you don't get married. I mean, so should you always be happy? No. In fact, if you're saying you should be happy through all that, that's really unhealthy. That's not biblical. Those are desires that God has given you. God's given us the desire to be vocationally fulfilled. God's given us the desire to want to have somebody to which we can spend our lives with. But Paul in the Bible is telling us, man, there's a difference between trusting your spouse and making your spouse your trust. See, there's a difference between making your career important and then making it your ultimate. Because there's only one thing that can be your ultimate. It's got to be God and what He has to say to you right here. We're going to set ourselves up for disaster otherwise. Paul said, listen, I know what it is to have some serious depressing circumstances. He said, I've been struck down, but I'm never in despair. Or I've been struck down, but I'm not crushed. You see the difference? The joy doesn't come from controlling his environment, but it's because of what's inside of him. He isn't brought to this point of utter despair. Man, it's tough, but he's got that joy that can coexist with his dire circumstances and gives him the ability to walk through it and believe and hope. So joy is possible, but it's going to depend on your allegiance, not your environment. And here's the last one. Joy can never be found directly. Lewis in Mere Christianity has this section. It's called Christian Behavior. And I always love the little section on hope, man. So cool. He talks about this. And different parts of it, but one is that you can't seek it directly. Okay, Psalm 1, it doesn't say, blessed is the person that seeks blessedness. Happy is the person that seeks happiness. Joyful is the person that seeks joy. Jesus said the same thing, right? Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5. He didn't say, you know, blessed is he that hungers and thirsts for wanting to be blessed. See, you can't seek it directly or it will escape you. You've got to want something more than the blessedness. Jesus said this. He said, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And guess what? All the other stuff will be added. You can't seek it directly. He's saying the reason you're happy is because you've made something else your trust. Which we can so easily do. Let's think about it now. Honesty time again. How many of us, you know, not a big deal, but maybe a little tweak on the taxes, you know? Or a lie here and there. Why do we break our promises? Because you know what, man? If I don't just tweak my taxes a little bit, I'm not going to make any money. And then I won't be happy. So what's your overarching reason that you're living your life and making the decisions you're making? Is it happiness or is it for the kingdom of God? I don't want to say this. You know how convicting it is to have try preaching this stuff, let alone listening to it. I mean, really. As long as your happiness is your top priority, guess what? You're never going to experience it. That's just the way it is. That's what the Bible tells us. Now, don't misunderstand me. God is committed to your happiness. He's committed to my happiness. But if you come to him to make you happy, guess what? You're desiring a false god. I mean, what is that, you know? Well, you know what? I don't like this Bible thing. I like Christianity. Maybe it can make me happy. You know, maybe God could help me get to my goals. It's not a god. That's a butler, man. You know, you pray. It's not even prayer. It's giving God instructions, you know? Here's what I need. Here's my goals. I want to be happy, and here's what I need to be happy. Listen, man, if he created you, guess what? He owns you. He owns me. Forget happiness, man. God, you own it all. You own me. Somehow we can actually reverse that, you know, and we come to God. It's like, okay, God, I'm going to give you a shot here, you know. Don't mess up. You know, I might drop you. You know, so, and then we follow God, and all of a sudden you ever hear somebody say, yeah, I don't understand it. I followed God, and I've been reading my Bible, and look at this, what happened. You know, I've been going to church, and look at all this stuff that has happened to me. In other words, you're saying my number one priority is happiness, and I'm using God to get there. God has become your means, not your end. You know what? The irony of the whole thing is the less you're concerned about your happiness and the more you're concerned about God, the happier you're going to be. The less you're concerned about your own joy and the more you're concerned about God, the more joy you're going to experience. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. He says, listen, if you aim for heaven, you'll get earth thrown in, but if you just aim for earth, you'll get neither. There it is, man. Happiness is always a byproduct. It's possible, number one. It is. Bible tells us it is. Go for it. It's there for us. Number two, it doesn't just come as a result of your environment, but of your allegiance being directed at God and His Word. And the less that you're concerned about your joy and your happiness, and the more you're concerned about Him, the happier you're going to be. Joy is never found directly. You know, years ago, we bought a piano, Tina and I. I don't know, what was it, Tina? Maybe 10 years ago, we broke our backs going to get the thing. I don't know, I probably dragged you into it, Joel. I don't remember. And we got the thing in the living room, in hopes, you know, well, it was years ago, I don't know, 10 years ago, in hopes that maybe, I don't know, one of our kids would learn to play it, you know? Maybe, I think we got Tara a couple lessons, didn't really work out. We tried with Alyssa, didn't work out. So now, here we are, we have this piano, and nobody knows how to play it. I mean, we should have just got a bookshelf. That's basically what it is. You know, nobody knows how to use it. Nobody knows how to play it. And it's just sitting there with knickknacks and pictures on it. Man, don't let this become like my piano. We need to learn how to play this thing. God, teach me how to sing Psalm 1. I need joy. I need something that's going to undergird me, man. He's 59 this summer. Ain't no joke anymore. You know, Bob gets mad at me. I tell him, Bob, we're going into our final trimester of life. Pastor, come on, man. He doesn't get any joy out of that one. Man, we got to learn how to sing the gospel. Don't just let it be sitting there. God, teach me how to play. But you know what? Jesus said there's one other thing you need to do. I mean, all these other things we talked about, but there's something. God gave us a memory. And sometimes it can plague you, but sometimes it's a blessing, isn't it? But he said, here's one way I want you to utilize this thing I gave you called memory to just keep you going, to undergird your joy, and that is to remember what I did for you. He's trying to tell us, man, there is such a consolation in understanding that all the punishment that I really deserve, he absorbed into his own body and made it his own for my sake. He that knew no sin became sin for me, that I could actually become the righteousness of God. That there is such consolation in that, people.